With that, Dr. Glenn Tonser, we always look forward to his comments this year. And this year, forward planning implications for herd rebuilding. Where do we fit as a stalker segment? Dr. Tonser.
Well, thank you, Dale. And I think I can hear myself, so can everybody hear me in the back? Likewise, it's a pleasure to be here. I agree it gets better every year. I guess it has nothing to do with the fact that I'm here every year. We'll give Dale and his team credit for that. But I do look forward to this event. I often say that Cattlemen's Day, Stalker Field Day, rank very highly on my priority list within my appointment, not just because they're big case meet events and I'm paid by the state, make that part make sense, but the fact that they're a focus for the cattle industry, and I know the vast majority of you here are here for the right reasons. You're interested in what we're talking about, right? They're dedicated meetings is what I'm getting at, and I very much look forward to them. So I hope you share that. I hope you get a lot out today. When Dale asked me to speak, he gave me a pretty open charge. Kind of like last year, I told you, you can blame us jointly if I get off track. But this year, what I'm going to do is give you a bit of a hybrid. So most of you here are wanting some outlook points. I have a lot of outlook-oriented comments, right, remarks to give you. But I'm going to focus throughout that on kind of playing my hand on what I think is going on herd expansion. And in doing so, I'm going to try to highlight what I think the implications all are for the background in the stalker segment. So I'm going to try to do that throughout and actually end with a summary of all those points. As always, we can take questions. If it's important clarification we can give, raise your hand. Otherwise, I do have time near the end for questions. Finally, I will tell you, there's only 30 or 35 slides, but instead of killing a tree or two trees, I didn't print out handouts for everybody. Instead, I have a handout up here you can get on your way to lunch that simply has this first slide and a website where all this information is at. So you'll have access to the specific numbers. You're welcome to write them down, but I'm more interested in you listening to me and us having a dialogue around that than you worrying about third decimal point stuff. So with that being said, let's charge forward. And I'm going to start by telling you what I told you last year. This doesn't mean I was right, but I think it's important to recognize what hasn't changed and some of the longer-term things that are at play here. Okay? So I put it at the top here, shared last year. But the situation summary, right, I think is important to recognize 90% is the same as what we talked about last year. There's a lot more excitement, and things are worth more than they were last year. But a lot of the end-of-the-day story is very similar. We have very tight supplies. We have very high prices. We have a surprisingly strong demand story. We actually have margins that are historically high from two, if not three, of the segments of the industry. And not everybody's comfortable with the cash it takes to be in the business. I think that fit last year. I think it all fits now. Add to that, we've been talking for probably 3 years at least about if we're going to expand the U.S. beef cow herd. We're going to talk about it again today, right? I brought it up last September. That's the focus now. I think it continues to get more and more interest because we continue to have more and more pinch points on the tight supply aspects of this that folks like you, right, that are margin operators, are directly impacted by the fact that fewer feeder cattle out there chase. Right? So a lot of this is the same. The part that may not be the same, and I spent more time on this last year, I'm just going to kind of remind you of it, is the environment around the beef industry and what you might think of as outside the beef industry continues to be more dynamic, yet the beef industry has to respond to it. So what the public is willing to accept in terms of how we raise our cattle, what they're willing to pay for the beef products, what information they want to be conveyed in the industry, continues to change. And the short summary would be is they are expecting more information flow, be able to know more about their product, and that continues to put pressure on the industry to share more information with them, vertically within the industry. Now, we haven't totally resolved that. That's not necessarily anything new, but on my highlight, I think a key implication for the stalker segment that still holds is the stalker segment is going to be asked to document more about where its animals came from, what it did to those animals, and provide that information forward to feed yards. I don't think any part of that's changed. I think it just continues to be ramped up by the ongoing interest of the public in how we raise them. Right. So very broadly, you remember I had some focus slides around that last year. I'm not going to re-give that talk, but I think it's important to remember that's still part of the story. Most of you know I like to give this kind of a slide. It doesn't matter if I'm giving a cow-calf focus, a tractor focus, feedlot focus talk, but to give you the supply summary, the demand summary, and then sum it up before we break down the individual sectors. And I'm going to do that here again. It's pretty clear. I sound like a broken record, but that's okay because you have to recognize that both of these are critical parts of profitability. We have tight supplies both in terms of the number of hooves in the system and now in terms of the beef pounds being produced. We've actually had some years in the past where we were producing fewer animals but more pounds because we had a slight reduction in the number of feeder cattle, but yet we had an offsetting increase in pounds per steer, right, with the feed yard industry. That's not the case anymore. Now, it might be again in the future, but for the last couple of years, that hasn't been going on, and certainly is not the case now. So you've got the very tight retail beef supplies, and it's critical to recognize that's a core part of why we have the sticker shock that's going on at the retail shelf, and why you have general public interest, right, in what's going on with beef industry more than we used to have. Along with that is, it's not just a supply story, it's actually a very positive demand story for consumers, right? Again, economists have two hands, I can describe everything from a supply and demand perspective, that's what I'm trying to do very broadly here. The public has placed more value on beef so far in 2014, and throughout 2013 actually, than most of us expected. I'm not gonna give you a beef demand focus talk, but rather I'm gonna highlight it. The second quarter of 2014, because most information I have is quarterly when it comes to meat demand, was the best year from a U.S. beef demand perspective in 10 years. Now, we also sold a lot fewer pounds than we have in most quarters in that 10-year period. So for those of you that are pausing trying to figure out what Tom is saying, let me try to clarify. We had lower per capita consumption, mainly because we produced less. We had a little bit of changes in trade, but mainly we produced fewer pounds. The price that cleared the market, the retail beef price that was observed in the second quarter, was much higher than most people, myself included, were expecting. The only way that can happen, if it exceeds expectations, is if there's a positive demand pull. Somebody out there among the U.S. consuming base saw more value and was willing to pay more for those pounds than we expected. The fact that we put fewer pounds out there tells me I should expect the price to go up. So if fewer pounds, people are going to bid over it. And frankly, somebody priced out of the market. That's the way the markets work. But if that price goes above that critical part, just to kind of see who gets what products, if it goes higher than expected, then I know it will be an improvement. More narrowly, I think consumers have been less sensitive to the price. They've been willing to pay more because they see more value in it. They like the taste profile. They like the improving convenience of products. And we actually have, it's no longer the representative consumer. The segment of our population that was not impacted by the recession is increasingly the largest target of beef consumers. So they're probably a little less price sensitive than what we talk about as price sensitivity 5 to 10 years ago, because you have an increasingly high income, fully employed segment that consumes a lot of your products. Right? I think you have to recognize all that. And I'm not going to give you full beef demand talk. I always belabor this first slide. It's set the stage for everything. But it's important to recognize it's not just the tight feeder cattle supply story that helps, but it's also a demand pull throughout the entire industry that's giving you these record prices. Sum all that up, we have these record prices. Not everybody's happy about that because it takes a lot more money to be in the business. Whether you are a cow-calf, a stocker, feed yard, retailer, it doesn't matter what segment we're talking about. Just the sheer capital it takes to operate is a lot higher than it's ever been, and not everybody's happy with that. I'm going to give you three or four examples of that in a moment where we actually have some record-level margins on a per-head basis, but not necessarily record-level returns on investment because it's taking a lot more money to get that same return. Most of you are nodding your head, you get that, but it's important to keep that in context, because there may be a little bit less interest in expanding or seeing the business, whatever, if the ROI isn't correct. It's no longer sufficient just to talk about records on a per head basis. That's nice, right? That's useful to recognize. But at the end of the day, when you're going to the banker, they're going to want to know what the ROI is, right? And if I'm an outside investor, you know, wanting to partner with you, I'm going to ask you about ROI also. So it's important to keep that in mind too. Okay? So now let's spend some time on the cow-calf sector. I know we have some of those in the room, but we're going to set the stage for the expansion discussion. This chart, several of you seem to use this in different places, but the y-axis continues to change depending on how long it's been since you've seen me talk. Vertically, what's on here is the dollars per cow that's estimated by LMIC, a group in Denver, Livestock Marketing Information Center, of the cash returns for the cow-calf industry. So it's return over cash cost. It's a barometer for profitability. On the horizontal axis, it goes back to 1986, and I have drawn a purple line. I recognize you can't see this in the back, but there's a purple line straight through the middle of this that's at roughly $150. Before 2013, we used to look at $150, roughly speaking, as a very good year from a return over cash cost perspective for the cow-calf industry. That's basically what we had back here in 2004 and 5, and we came close to hitting it in 2013. What we have up here on the far right is a projection, because we're three-fourths of the way through 2014, that 2014 and 2015 will be not just record-setting, but astronomically record-setting here. Narrowly, you see how tall those bars are, and they go up in excess of $450. So the y-axis, the chart is changing drastically. It makes all these bars look smaller than they used to because we changed the chart. So I'm not trying to pull a fast one on you. I'm talking through it to call your attention to it. Why has this occurred? Calf prices have went up, notably. Production costs have went down, notably. Both of those improved the margin, notably. pretty simple, right? Both those key factors are driving this. That's why almost everybody you talk to thinks 2014 will be a record-setting year for what we're going to call a typical cow-calf producer. Now, if you find yourself operating in California dealing with the drought, this isn't necessarily your story. But when we talk about the U.S. in aggregate for the cow-calf industry, I think this is the story. 2014 is probably going to be the best year that the typical producer has had during their time horizon being a cow-calf operator. Most economists think, myself included, the cow-calf industry is largely a commodity business, and we tend to bid these margins away over time. And I fully expect that to occur here as well. Over time, the way that happens is we expand the herd, we put pressure on some of those output prices, and we squeeze these margins. Now, that takes time, but the way that occurs is you expand the herd if you listen to it. So this sets the stage of expectations that we will start to expand the herd to have more calves to get these margins, and we'll put pressure on these margins. Okay? And I also think we're going to expand the herd to do that. This right here is a price chart for 4 to 5 weight Southern Plains steers. I want to give you the quick lesson. The solid blue line is the current year. It looks like black, probably in the back of the room, but dark blue is last year's 2013. And then the red line is the prior 5-year average. It's important to recognize that pretty much since last June, so when we get on this darker dotted line, we've had a bull market. There's some individual weeks that's came down, but there's not really a 5-week period you had a drop. Right? I mean, there's a little bit of week-by-week variability. But in general, since last June, we've had a bull market for this weight class, as well as 7-8 weight steers. What isn't clear when you look at those two, and I'm up here just giving lots of slides at you, is the price differential between the 7-8 weight class and the 4-5 class has also been changing. Right? Some people refer to that as the price rollback at one point in time, and you look at the weights, the prices of different classes and so forth. That's what I want to highlight here. We're talking to the background of the stocker segment. That's what you're about, right? What is the value putting on those additional pounds? What's it cost you to do it? And that's your return. We all recognize that. But I want to call your attention to basically whatever rule of thumb you used to use. I don't want to tell you to throw it away, but I do want to tell you to reevaluate it. Right? So it might hold, but I think you got to do some more homework. And I'm going to give you an example of that. So even if it holds and you want to tell me your homework was wasted, so be it. It's good to do homework. But some of you are probably operating under some broken rules of thumb at this point. I'll give you an example of that. Those two charts right there told you about the bull market for 4-5 weights, as well as 7-8 weights. That goes back to last June. What I did was went longer back in time, and I took those same two weight categories, took Kansas prices for them, and I went all the way back to 1992. Great history lesson. And what I did was I tabulated what is that price spread between those two weight classes. Lighter animals tend to be more, right, on a dollar per hundredweight basis, but how much more over time? And then I also took that spread as a percent of the value of the lighter animal. So it's one thing to talk about what's the dollar per hundredweight difference in levels. That's what I'm going to belabor, and that's what we're talking about in the last two charts. It's another thing to say as a percent of the lightweight value. In a relative sense, how much is going to change? That's what I'm trying to summarize here. So I know you can't read the numbers, I'll just give you the punchline here. But this middle column, which is green, is simply the spread on dollars per hundredweight basis between the 4-5s and the 7-8 weights. And we used to have, back in the 90s, a $15 roughly spread, right, or the rollback, since I was talking referred. Between 2000 and 2010, it was roughly $25. And then more recently, 2011 through 14, I have up here by individual years, it's been increasing. $25 in 2011, $40 in 2012, $37 in 2013, so far $60 average in 2014. So the magnitude of the difference in prices between the lightweights and the heavyweights used to be fairly constant, but it's been growing over the last 3 or 4 years. Everybody follow me? This leads to what I call sticker shock, hence the top bullet here, from somebody that's trying to buy that 4-5 weight. It also leads to the excitement of the cow-calf guys trying to sell it, right? So that's both ways. What's in the purple column, and what I really want to call your attention to, is the relative change in value is not nearly as stark. So again, I took this spread in prices, and I divided it by the value, the price, of that lower weight animal. That's what's in purple. And you can see, again, back in the 90s, it was basically 16-17%. The spread as a function of the value of that lighter weight animal. It was 20% here in the 2000s, and it's hovered around that until 2014, it's up to 24. So not only has the spread increased in levels, but it also has, relatively speaking, right, relative value of a lightweight animal, but not nearly as much. And a lot of us are visual learners, so that same information is on this chart. Okay? On the left-hand side, I have the price spread, and this looks like blue to me. Hopefully it's blue to you in the back of the room. So the blue dashed line again, is simply the difference between the 4-5 price and the 7-8. And it was fairly flat in this, you know, $15 to $20 range early on in the 90s, and it slowly increased. And then way over here, far right, we jumped from 2013 to 2014. We went from that $40 spread to $60 I just showed you, right? That blue spike on the far right. Contrast that with the green line. The green line is just relative to the value of a lighter animal measure. See how much more flat it is? Yes, there is one year where you have this, you know, peak down here, or sorry, trough in 1996, but let's ignore the one-year point. The longer-term story is, relative to the value of the animal, things haven't been changing nearly as much. Why am I telling you this? Whatever rule of thumb you used to use, such as if there's a $20 rollback in the prices, it doesn't make sense or it does make sense to place, or 25, or whatever rule you used to use, I encourage you to throw it out. Because that old rule of thumb was based upon animals that were worth a lot less. That 20 bucks used to be a lot higher percent of value on the four weights than it is today. Is everybody following me? I'm going to give you the numeric examples in a minute, but it actually looks like a profitable time to place those very expensive 4-5 weights. But using a typical rule of thumb that has a $50 or $60 rollback would tell you not to. Right? Now, it takes a lot more cash to do it, we've already noted that, but your rule of thumb of 20 or 25 bucks would misguide you today is the point. Okay? I'm happy to clarify that more if you need to. I know I throw a lot of numbers at you, but the point is to recheck those rules of thumb that used to be a fixed monetary amount that didn't consider the changing value of the animal, so you need to do a relative assessment. Okay? Several of you know our Ag Manager website. We have a lot of information on there. One of the things that's on there is this kind of a chart. And what it is a projection of prices for three different Kansas auctions, Salina, Dodge City, and Pratt, for the next roughly 4 months. I'm going to show you two versions of this. The first one is for 550-pound steers, and basically the point I want to make is we're expecting throughout the rest of September and October prices to be in the low 240s, and we have this fall-off. The reason we have the fall-off is these are futures market-based, basis-adjusted forecasts, so we roll out to the next futures contract. Right? Anybody who's watching the board knows there's a $7 to $10 fall-off when you go out a couple contracts. So when we get out here to December, we have a fall-off to the mid-230s. But that gives you some sense of what the market is saying prices are going to be if you're in the market to buy 550-pounders sometime in the next 3 or 4 months. This is the same type of chart, but I put purple at the top because it's for 750-pounders. So we're doing the same exercise, but we obviously have a different basis expectation. Right? So a heavier animal we're projecting, but the same market dynamics are at play. Throughout the rest of September and October, we're projecting 750-pound steers here in Kansas to be in the low 220s, 220 to 223, depending on the week you look at this chart, and then fall off to about 215, 216 on out through November, December. You can do your own price spread on those. That's equivalent of the historical version we just did, right? I give you the backwards-looking point, these are the forward-looking numbers. I told you I was going to focus some remarks on herd expansion. One of the reasons I think we're in the process, not just going to, but I think we're in the process of expanding the herd, is we finally have a national situation, again, I don't want to ignore parts of the West, but an aggregate of range, pasture, and moisture conditions that will support it. And that's what this chart says, right? Now, you guys have probably seen versions of these before, but in this kind of a chart, we're plotting the percent of acres, range and pasture acreage, that's in poor, very poor condition. So the lower the number, the better. Right? The lower the number, the better range of pasture conditions are. And this current blue line, being not just lower than last year, but a lot lower than the five-year average, means, in general, for the whole U.S., range of pasture is in a lot better condition. In the top right is a table that tells you how many cows are in better conditions. Right? Because U.S. cow herd is not just uniformly distributed 2% of the herd in all 50 states. You all know that, but when I just give you a total acreage number, that's kind of what, that's what you're basing your assessment on. If you recognize the fact that Texas has a lot more and other states have a lot more cows than 2%, right, which we all recognize, the germane question is, what's the improvement in the distribution of where the cows are? Last year, back in the middle of September, a third of U.S. beef cows in this country were in areas that had pasture range conditions in poor or very poor, in the worst conditions the way USDA stored them. The more current number for September 2014 is 5 to 6%. So we've had a notable improvement in terms of the number of cows that are in bad conditions. And therefore, by extension, I think the typical cow-calf producer is a little bit more comfortable pulling the trigger to expand than they might have been a year ago. Right? There's regional variation in that, but in aggregate, I think that's a fair statement. Not everybody's comfortable with the cash it takes to do it and so on and so forth, But what I'm trying to highlight is the pasture conditions are probably facilitating it in aggregate much better than they did this time last year. Most of you know a couple of the key reports I watch, and not just me, all the analysts that you're interested in hearing our wonderful insights from, is January, July cattle inventory reports. It's two times a year from USDA, we get insights on the number of heifers that are being retained. So in the spirit of talking about herd expansion, that's important to remind us. The most recent July cattle inventory report, what I'm showing you here is three or four slides on that from that report. The first one is, they tell us how many feeder cattle are out there around the country. Right? 2 points to note. One is, we didn't have this information last year. I'm not saying that somebody dropped the ball, I'm just reminding you that for budget concerns, we didn't have a July 2013 report, hence I have a gap in this chart. But the 2014 number, even if we had one last year, is much lower than we've ever had before. This is consistent with the point there's fewer hooves out there. There's fewer feeder cattle for all of you to go out and bid and chase and put into your stocker operations. This confirms what you already know. This chart right here is from that same July cattle inventory report, but it's their estimate of how many heifers are being retained. And this was a bit of a surprise to me and others. So when this report came out, I had to tell the world there's mixed signals on whether or not we're expanding the herd. I'll try to tell you why I said there's mixed signals. But specifically, the estimate was there's actually fewer heifers being retained. Narrowly 2.4% fewer heifers were estimated in this July of 2014 report compared to 2012-2013. Most people, including yours truly, thought that'd be a small positive, because we thought we saw all the signs that there's fewer heifers showing up in the feed yard, looking at price premiums in auction markets and so forth. We thought we observed expansion, right? And we thought this would be the first report that kind of confirmed it. Moreover, the January report, the same type of chart, USDA told us that there was more heifers. So we thought there'd be a continuation of that in July. That's not what the USDA report said. So what I want to be very clear about, the best I can, is there are mixed signals of whether we've already started to expand or not. If you look at the July heifer retention number, it says we have not pulled the trigger on expansion. If you look at the portion of steers and heifers in feed yard placements, it says we have. And if you look by historical comparisons, the relationship between steer and heifer prices in different auctions, it says we have. So the net of those mixed signals opens this up for debate, but I'm here to tell you I think we've expanded the herd, and this one report will look like an outlier after we get the next January or July cattle inventory reports. But being very transparent, telling you there are mixed signals depending on the reports you follow. That begs the question, okay, how many cows are we going to add, how fast will we add cows, and what are the implications of stocker savings? So that's all to set that up. This chart right here gives you the cattle cycles. A lot of producers like to talk about cattle cycles in a historical sense. So for example, I've put a purple box right here, right after the solid blue line, because when you talk about cycles, we are probably at the end of what's labeled up here is the 2004 to 2014 cattle cycle. Right? And you can see we had this peak 3 or 4 years in to that. We've been falling off, i.e. we have fewer cows for several years in a row. Historically, when you look at this, cycles have went 8 to 12 years. That's what this shows you over time. And the question mark is, are we finally at the point where we're going to start expanding? So if you use the, I just told you don't use rules of thumb, but if you use one that says 8 to 12 years, then we're due to turn. Right? I'm not a huge believer in making all those kind of assessments based on cattle cycle, because there's a lot of things that are different than they were in the 60s or 70s when these former cycles were comparing to. The gaps between the peaks and the troughs in these cycles have been declining over time. And I can talk more about that if you want, but we're less responsive because we need fewer cows to produce a given beef target. So the whole notion of cycles isn't the same as it used to be. So I think it could be misleading, but nonetheless, since we talk about it all the time, if you believe in cycles, cycle charts say we're due to expand. It's a reason to share it. How much will we expand and how fast? I'll share two different projections, and then I'll try to play my hand before Ken makes me play my hand of where we fall on this, because I know it'll be one of his questions. What's up on here is the blue line from ERS. Every February, ERS puts out 10-year projections on many things, including how large the U.S. beef cow herd will be. I'm very anxious to see what their February 2015 numbers will be, because these are now dated, but that's what I'm sharing with you. And what they've projected is what you might call an optimistic expectation that 10 years out, so the far right here is the year 2023, we would have a beef cow inventory of 33.7 million head. And that would be 16% more than we started 2014. So let's look at that as the optimistic, notable expansion type forecast. The red line is from FAFRI, which is a joint effort you probably heard about from the University of Missouri and Iowa State, and it has a little more cyclical nature to it, and it never peaks out at nearly the same number of cows as that ERS projection. narrowly it peaks out in 2018 and 19, and never hits 31 million cows. We currently have basically 29 million cows. It says we won't add a full 2 million. DRS numbers say we'll add at least 4.5 million cows, right? So those are the contrasts. So I told you I'm going to answer where I fall before Ken asked me. I've been telling everybody I'm slightly less optimistic in the DRS number, but I'm much more optimistic in terms of the number of cows we'll have than the factory numbers. And I'll tell you why I say that. I think there's a global demand for more meat. I'm a firm believer the economies outside the U.S. are going to grow more than they do in the U.S. We're going to continue to expand our exports in all meats, including beef. And the world's going to tell us to produce more meat. And in order to do that, we're going to need more cattle. And I think the fat-free expectations are, if you like, too bearish on the demand setting going forward. But I think the maybe naively optimistic ERS number says cow-calf producers will respond to these margins like a spreadsheet model that Tundra might build. I think it probably overestimates that, and it doesn't give the producer, it doesn't recognize conservative responses by producers. You know, a lot of producers don't want to be green for 2 years, not just 2 months, right, before they expand. Not all producers are going to be happy paying $3,200 for replacement, so on and so forth. Okay. Add all that up, I don't know that we'll see as spreadsheet-based expansion that you get in the ERS model. So I'm not expecting quite as much as them, but definitely more than the factory one. Now, sidebar, I recognize I'm an academic economist that just told you I'm somewhere between these two, right? And I hate when people do that. But hopefully you followed my reasoning on why I'm thinking that way. Okay? So the punchline of that is, I mean, we're going to expand the herd, but if you look at the ERS numbers, we're going to add 15 or 16% more cows, and therefore that many more calves, over the next 10 years. So, you know, we're not going to double the size of the herd. We're going to have tight supplies for a while, probably, that's the point. So what are the implications of that? Well, first, let's look at what the short-term, immediate kind of implications are in terms of margins. They're out there for fall placements. I always like to highlight this beefbasis.com resource. The link's down there at the bottom. And most of you know I use this. I choose the Salina markets and keep my own head straight about which market I'm doing. But this morning what I did was this hypothetical. I went out saying, what if I want to buy a 550-pound steer at the Salina market on October 1st? So I'm doing this next week. My forecast of that this morning was I'm going to pay $246 for that steer. And what if I plan to put 200 pounds on and sell it the first week of January, which equates to basically 2 pounds a day, every day of the game. That's the scenario I've painted here. Currently, using this resource, I'm projecting I'd sell that animal for $217, so you can calculate your own rollback and so forth through your own rules of thumb, but that amounts to a value gain of $138 per 100 weight, which is a lot higher than we've historically had. So now the main question is, what's your cost of gain in doing that, and how comfortable are you with the risk around that projected output price? All right, you got to recognize both of those, because none of this is certain, those are projections. But if you had a cost of gain of $90, just to give us an example to walk around, that amounts to an expected profit of just under $100. Again, better than we've had a lot of times in the past. But consistent with my point earlier on, it takes more cash to operate. You have to recognize by the time you buy that animal and then you put those 200 pounds on, you're going to have over $1,500 tied up in an animal. So from an ROI perspective, right, are you willing to put the $1,500 out there for 3 months to get a $100 return and absorb the risk? This room's going to be very mixed on that. Okay. And I recognize that. If you can do that $100 and absorb all the risk for $700 investment, you're going to be a lot more willing to do it. I think we all understand the basic point. I was highlighting to you that that trade-off is always there, but the number of zeros in it continues to be magnified. This chart right here, I recognize that has lots of zeros. I'm not going to read through all of it, but I want to call your attention to the fact that that beef basis resource that I keep bringing to you, and I always use that 550 to 750 example, can be tailored very easily. That's the purpose of including this. You can go in and change the sale date, you can change the buy date, you can change actual location if you drove here from Oklahoma or whatever. We have locations in that tool that aren't Kansas, right? So there's other ones, and change to fit your scenario. That's the only reason I include this. I did lots of variations of it as my own kind of BS check on the resource, sorry, and I just copy and pasted that spreadsheet in here to show you, you can get a lot of different projected value gains as you change the placement weight, the outweight, the outdate, the assumed performance, and so forth. It's a very useful tool, and I encourage you to use it. To round this out from the feedlot perspective, before I give you prescriptive short-run and long-run implications, because some of you in the room might have feedlot exposure maintained longer, not just the stocker industry, I will confess the feed yard margins for 2014 have been a lot better than I expected, and that's wonderful since I work at K-State, and feed yards are a big deal in the state. Right? I entered the year pretty pessimistic on returns, and I've been proven wrong for, what, 9 months straight now. So I have no problem telling you that. I think it's important to recognize why that's occurred. We've had fed cattle price increases that have continued for a good chunk of the year, and they, you know, they rationalized paying more and more for feeder cattle before those cattle got worth more. So they had feeder cattle price increases throughout this period as well, right? And it actually kind of rewarded, if you like, speculative buying that didn't necessarily make sense at the time and place. Because if you push the pencil on what we expect the fed cattle price to be and we expect corn to be, you would not have had record returns being projected at the time of placement. But post-placement, we've had enough of an offsetting improvement in fed cattle prices that we've actually had very good returns month by month. So that's good, right? But I'm highlighting that that doesn't always work that way. Right? Sometimes it works the other way, and I'm concerned about the fourth quarter. Monthly, I put out this projection of returns for the feedlot industry. It's actually backwards-looking and forwards-looking, so we try to say what returns have been in the past, and we project for the next 6 months of closeouts. A couple things to highlight. There's a delay in this. We make use of the Focus on Feedlot survey, which actually comes from the ASI department. I'm very appreciative of that. Nearly all the animal performance, all the placement, in-weight, out-weight type stuff for this exercise comes from that. So we think it's representative of what's going on in the Kansas feedyard industry in a broad sense. Again, it doesn't reflect any one yard perfectly, but it gets the trends over time. And then we couple lots of market price information with that to do this. Okay? I can tell you more if you want, but that's price decision from here. There's a lag in that information. I'm always a month behind in getting the Focus on Feedlot information because it's survey-based. The July returns, we estimated, were $310 positive per steer. The best on record. The previous record was $308 in October of 2003. Right? So we broke the record by $2 per head. Consistent with my points a minute ago, and I'll flip back my slide in a moment, it took a lot more money to get that $310 than it took to get that $308 back in October of 2003. That's at the bottom here. The July 2014 closeout, our estimate says it took $1,881 total cost to get that steer to the finish line. Back in 2003, it took less than $1,000. So again, you don't need a calculator. You get basically the same dollars per head with half the investment. The ROI is a lot better on that 03 closeout than more recently. That doesn't mean these July returns weren't welcome. I have no doubt there have been a feed yard like the fact they were records. But I think context is important, right? We've had better months on an ROI perspective. I highlight that because it's not just the stocker segment or even the cow-calf returns segment where these ROIs may not be records even when dollars per head are. It applies to the feedyard industry as well. Why am I concerned about the fourth quarter? I just went backwards a slide on you. This is projections over the next 6 months on closeouts. In the middle here, we have October through December, and they become negative numbers. The reason the projections are negative is the current board has fed cattle prices setting records, but not nearly enough to offset the record prices that were paid for those feeder cattle. You can read the numbers, but that's the punchline of it. We need additional growth, upward movement in fed cattle prices over the next 3 months for this exercise to offset the record placement price of feeder cattle. Maybe that'll happen. I started this off telling you for 9 months in a row it's happened and I've been wrong, right? So that's possible. But I'm very concerned about the fourth quarter because it hasn't happened yet. It could happen, but that's why I'm concerned about fourth quarter returns. Okay? Here's numbers. The arrows are what is relevant. This is LMIC quarterly information. It now goes out through 2016. So some of you see me more often, and these numbers don't change a lot each time. But once a year, LMIC is able to go in and basically add the next year because they try to forecast the next 8 quarters. So it's kind of chunky. And we're now to the point where we can make some projections about 2016 in addition to 2015. The reason I'm telling you that is if it's been a while since you went and looked at these numbers off the web, it's probably a good time to pull up this slide because now you can look at 2016 numbers. 2 months ago, you couldn't, actually 3 weeks ago, you couldn't have done that. But the general trend is the same. Commercial slaughter is expected to go down, hence the purple arrow on the left is still going down. We're going to continue to have fewer animals in the system. I think we all recognize that. The middle arrow is average dress weights is expected to keep going up. So we're going to try to offset it, but we're going to fail in aggregate to do so. So on the far right, commercial beef production, number of beef pounds now instead of hooves, is going to keep coming down. Narrowly, for 2014, we have 6% fewer animals being slaughtered and about 5% fewer pounds being produced. Again, hence that tight supply story on these record prices I talked about a moment ago. That's going to continue through 2015, but the magnitudes of those pullbacks are going to dwindle. In other words, we're going to slowly get some improvement in the situation, but it takes time. We get out to 2016, we might have just a 1% further reduction in the herd, and we may actually have close to flat changes in beef supplies. So the consumer relief perspective in terms of pounds we're offering might show up in 2016. I would actually say earlier, it'll be early 2017 before we're able to say that confidently. There's at least two more years of the tight supply story is going on. Here's the parallel price information. On the left-hand side is the five market average for fed cattle. We're up 20% is projection for the year for 2014. We're obviously three-fourths of the year, way through the year. We're up more than that when we look at 7-8 weights or 5-6 weights. You guys know what the current prices are. For 2015, which is the middle range here, LMIC is projecting an additional 4% increase in fed cattle price, an additional 10, maybe $20 increase in 7-8 weights, and an additional $15 to $20 increase in those 4-5s. So if that holds true, right, go back to where I was at 15 slides ago, that dollar per hundred weight rollback is being projected to continue to increase, but not necessarily as a percent of the value of the lighter animal, because the lighter animal is also getting more valuable. So the lesson that I was trying to drive there on don't use your dollar per hundred weight rollback, you need to keep that in mind also when we're looking at 2015, right, a year from now, the replacements. Okay? We're going to have, most likely, higher priced animals throughout the chain, but as a percent of the value of the lighter placed animal, it may not be any higher. We're going to take more money to do it, right? Instead of $1,500, it might take $1,600 next year to do what you're doing, but it still might make sense. Okay? Does everybody follow that general point? All right. I already made this comment. Beef demand was the best in the second quarter for 10 years. The numbers up here is what I was trying to get English to when it started off on the first slide. But the punchline is we produced 3% less beef per person in the second quarter than we did the second quarter of 2013. If we would have observed prices, retail prices now, would have went up by 3%, I would have told you demand was flat. In other words, that reduction in pounds we put out there for people to bid over, I expected to lead to basically a 3% increase in retail beef price. That was the offsetting factor I was looking for. What actually occurred was retail beef prices went up 10%. 10 is bigger than 3, right? Prices went up a lot more than we expected, and that could only happen if there's more value viewed in that product and the public was less price sensitive than I was assuming when I identified that 3% increase in price of what I expected. That's a very good story, right? I'm trying to remind you, you can't ignore the importance of demand, even though it's simpler to talk about supply. The second quarter was a very, very good quarter from a beef demand perspective. All right, so let's wrap this up. I think there's short-run and long-run implications of this tight cattle supply, pending expansion, I'll say gonna be expansion of the herd. In the short run, I know these are small, so I want you to listen to me instead of respond. Short run impacts are, I encourage you to be more flexible and recheck those rules of thumb. Hopefully you follow me on that dollar per hundred weight. You know, $20 may not be the right rule to use anymore. Do it as a function related to the value of the animal and actually do the full calculation on returns. And to drive that point home a little differently, be open to changing your planned average daily gain. So somebody out there might be able to, for example, buy a 550 pounder, like I said, in Salina next week, and might plan on putting 200 pounds on, just like I said, right? And maybe they can do that with an expectation of 1.8 average daily gain without a lot of supplementation and minimal additional investment. That same person in the audience might be able to alternatively supplement, manage differently, and chase a 2.4 performance, right? What I'm encouraging you to do is you're going to have fewer animals to do this with because there's just fewer that exist. Do that second calculation on how hard I push and whether it makes sense to supplement or not, right? And Dale can give this talk more. I'm setting the stage for it for his questions and so forth later. But I think that is going to be the secret to maintaining some profitability with fewer head in the industry. And the numbers up here basically just highlights if you could go from a 1.8 gain on just putting 100 pounds on that 550 pounder to 2.4. If you could do that for basically $30 a hundred weight, the market would reward you. Because at the moment, the difference in the value of gain projections is $37, because you're getting a same weight animal, but you're getting it to the market earlier. Right? That's the point. You can do that because you more aggressively feed, and you avoid the current rollback in feeder cattle futures contracts. That's what's going on beneath that. Remember my comment about the next 2 months they roll back some? If you could avoid that for less than the $30 per hundred weight, you're better off. Right. That's the best example I can give you today of that. Use the beefbasics.com resource that I've walked through to do your own version of that and do it again the next day you wake up, do it again the next day. You know, the internet, once you're on it once, keep doing it. That's the point, because these numbers, they're not accurate now because I did it a couple hours ago. Right? But you need to get the point here and reevaluate those rules of thumb. Longer run, and hopefully this sets the stage for broader questions. I think it ties into some of your subsequent talks. Some of these were shared last year, but I don't think we should ignore them. The stalker segment, I would submit, is going to become more specialized than it used to. And the reason I say that is there's a segment of cow-calf producers that traditionally also background. And some of them, in order to add cows, if you believe the notion we're going to add cows to the system, are probably going to make a change from backgrounding. Say they have 100 cows and we typically background. Now I'm going to make the switch to have 120 cows and we'll background less, if not at all, to make the use of their own forage base because the market's saying add calves to the system. Right? The industry still has to put pounds on those calves somewhere, but the argument would be, and I'm trying to paint, is maybe the backgrounding and stocker side of things will become more specialized and separated from the cow-calf side as a way to add cows and therefore calves with a tight land base. Everybody follow the point? Lots of people talk about, we don't have land, I can't expand. I don't want to ignore that, but if there are anywhere near the economic returns that the LMIC chart that I gave you for cow-calf exists, I think there's enough money on the table. Somebody's going to figure out how to manage cows a little differently. And part of that might be you more intensely manage your 100 cows, right? And part of that could be instead of putting 100 pounds on the background, or I put 10 or none, right? And we let the stalker segment become more specialized with those pounds. That's the point I'm trying to make. I don't think it'll fit everybody, but in aggregate to the industry, I think that'll be part of the puzzle on how we add more calves to the total industry size and yet still get those animals to a finished weight we need to feed them. The second point here, I'd encourage you to be mindful of geographic shifts that are underway. I would submit that the cow-calf industry is slowly moving north and west. I can belabor that details if you want with the data. I think the expansion will be likewise more north and west than it used to be in the industry for various reasons. The implication of that is, in aggregate, sourcing stockers is going to be more north and west than it used to be. So if you had a relationship with somebody in the southeast is still going to be relevant. But they may represent fewer portion of the total calf than they did 10 years ago, so be mindful of that. You may have to start buying from northwest of where you used to buy, is the point. Okay? Likewise, I'm very concerned about the feed yard industry. That was pretty clear about the fourth quarter. But long term, we still have too many bumps. We have too much concrete bump space relative to calf supplies. It's going to get worse if we start holding back heifers, right? Fewer animals, same concrete bump space. I fully expect, and this is not popular, we're going to have additional feed yards for sale, mothballing of them. And the net effect of that, I think, is going to be whatever we want to call the center of the feed yard industry is going to be more north and east of where it used to be. And we can talk about that if you want, and why I'm more concerned about Southern Plains and not even Nebraska in that story. We can do that in question if you want. But the implication of that would be you're selling to a feed yard, all else equal, your destination feed yard might be more north and east than it used to be. So be aware of that. Okay? I made a comment earlier about the public's interest in how we produce, raise our animals, produce our food. Gave lots of quotes from CFI and so forth last year I'll remind you of. But the broader issue of social issues and concerns and having an answer to the public controls the dollar you need isn't going away. So long run, I think that has to be on this list that we're mindful of. It's also consistent with our antibiotic talk that's coming this afternoon. That fits into that as well. I mean, so there's some tie-ins here. And then lastly, I made the comment earlier about information flow. I think there's going to be ongoing requests slash mandates from the public for quality assurance and verification. You ask the public to pay for more than they used to pay for something, they're going to ask more questions. I think we can keep them at the table, and so far beef demand has been strong, so we've succeeded. But you have to recognize they're going to keep asking questions, and the more you ask them to pay, they're probably going to keep asking more and more. So the industry in aggregate is going to have to share more information than they did in the past. All right. I've pretty much made these summary points. I'm pretty optimistic. It's the bottom point, opportunity or threat. But given the notion of it takes more cash to be in this business than it ever did before, not everybody sees those opportunities. Some see it as a threat or a concern. So the industry's mixed, right? I'm pretty bullish on anytime there's a lot more money in the industry to manage, that comes with opportunity. But I think you also have to recognize it also means if you don't manage it well, you get upside down quicker, right? I think everybody follows that from my comments, but that's my summary point. So Dale, with that, I have handouts, like I told you, don't come up now, but when you break for lunch, that has the first slide, which is just title so you remember where you were, and then this slide, which is the link to the actual slides on the web. And if you have any other questions, I'd be happy to take them over the time we have.